in the shadows, in the sky. It's Paranexus Universe.
Good evening and welcome to Paranexus Universe. Today is April 6th, 2011, and granted it is Wednesday, by the way. My name is Brian Parsons. You're probably not used to hearing my voice intro the show, but as always, we have Doug Kelly and Grant Rubendunst in the house.
Hey.
Hey, welcome everybody.
Welcome tonight. Got a great show coming up.
We have a very interesting show tonight, and if you have a question, the number's there at the top of the screen, or feel free to type away here in the chat room. I guess I'll read the little bio here for our guest. Tonight's guest, if you haven't figured it out yet, then it's right there at the top of the screen. Benjamin Radford, who is the managing editor of Skeptical Inquirer Science Magazine and a research fellow with the nonprofit educational organization, the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. He has written hundreds of articles on a wide variety of topics, including urban legends, the paranormal, critical thinking, and science literacy. He is the author of 6 books, Hoaxes, Myths, and Manias, Why We Need Critical Thinking, Media Mythmakers, How Journalists, Activists, and Advertisers Mislead Us, Lake Monster Mysteries, Investigating the World's Most Elusive Creatures, Scientific Paranormal Investigation, How to Solve Unexplained Mysteries, Tracking the Chupacabra, The Vampire Beast in Fact, Fiction, and Folklore, and The Sky is Falling, A Colorful History of Media Panics, which is due out later this year. Radford is a regular columnist for LiveScience.com, Discovery News, and Skeptical Inquirer magazine. He's also created Playing Gods, the board game of divine domination, the world's first satirical board game of religious warfare. He's also a filmmaker and released 2 short films, Clicker Clatter and Sirens. Radford is one of the world's few science-based paranormal investigators and has done firsthand research into mysterious phenomena, including psychics, ghosts, and haunted houses, exorcisms, miracles, Bigfoot, stigmata, lake monsters, UFO sightings, reincarnation, crop circles, and many other topics. He's perhaps best known for solving the mysteries of the Santa Fe courthouse ghost in 2007 and the Hispanic vampire El Chupacabra in 2010. Radford has appeared on the Discovery Channel, History Channel, National Geographic Channel, Learning Channel, CBS, CBC, BBC, CNN, and a lot of other 3-letter networks.
Yes, but has he appeared on the Doug Channel?
Which channel?
The Doug Channel.
Oh. Yeah, there you go.
Well, he's on Paranexus Universe tonight.
There you go.
And something I'm interested in, he's also written something with the episode of CSI.
Terrific.
The crime scene show, which is pretty cool, I think. Now, personally, I'd heard of Ben Radford, but it wasn't until I read his article, Ghost Hunting Mistakes, Science and Pseudoscience and Ghost Investigations, in the November-December edition of Skeptical Inquirer, that I really began to take notice of what he's done. And yes, I said I read the Skeptical Inquirer. And I loved this article so much that I wrote about it in the Paranexus blogs. Many of these topics I've talked about in other blogs and other engagements. And before we get in, we're going to talk about the book that he wrote about that, and as well as the Chupacabra stuff. But before we do all that, we have to welcome Benjamin Radford to Paranexus Universe. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks. Good to be on. Good to finally talk to you guys.
Pleasure to have you with us. We're looking forward to our chat tonight and kicking some stuff around with you.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, I know you're a little bit busy lately, huh? Just a little.
Yeah, well, I generally have sort of a background level of crazy busyness, but the last month or so, especially since my Chupacabra book's come out, it's been especially crazy. It's actually been more widely talked about than I had sort of expected. It's gratifying, but it's interesting.
Yeah, I don't think I've gone more than a day or two without reading an article or hearing about the Chupacabra story. But it is really exciting because it's good to see science in action and somebody actually dig into this mystery and disseminate the information and provide facts. So my hat's off to you with the work with the Chupacabra. It's going to be sad now that, you know, it's changed, but.
Well, yeah, I mean, the reality is that people will continue to find weird things and people will still call them the Chupacabras. And so it's, I don't expect that my book and my research is going to definitively end the myth. I think that the people that bother to read it and understand it will get it, and everybody else will continue to see Chupacabras wherever they go.
You mean he's not real?
I didn't say it wasn't real.
Oh, no.
You've broken Grant's heart.
Uh-oh. Let me go reach for my antidepressants.
You'll be all right.
Okay. I'll try to hang in there. So tell us a little bit about your book.
The Chupacabra book?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the result of 5 years of research. As Brian mentioned in the intro, I'd previously done research into mysterious creatures and cryptozoology with the 2007 book that I co-authored with Joe Nickel called Lake Monster Mysteries. And I've also written about and done research on Bigfoot and things like that, and Spring-Heel Jack and Mothman and all that. So this was just sort of an extension of the research that I'd already done. But what really intrigued me, especially about the Chupacabra, was that for a creature that was so well known, I mean, it's the world's third best known monster after Bigfoot and Nessie of Loch Ness, there was remarkably little actual good research done on it. And the other thing that really intrigued me was that it's a vampire. Unlike Bigfoot, unlike Nessie and most other creatures that we talk about as being possibly real, it sucks blood. And so I'm thinking, this is cool. How come nobody else had really done any real solid research on it? And so I figured, well, what the hell? I'll waste my time on it.
So when did your investigation into the Chupacabra begin?
It sort of began piecemeal. I would say probably around 2005 or so, give or take. I had done some research on it just sort of as background research, and doing other cryptozoological interests. And then I was I participated in the TV show Monster Quest, and they flew me out to Cuero, Texas, outside of San Antonio, to go examine the most famous Chupacabra in the world, the one found by Phyllis Canyon in 2007. And so I went out there and met Phyllis and saw her dead head and did some research there. And at that point, I was sort of just collecting bits and pieces of the mystery. Basically, I tried to take, as I do with all my investigations, one sort of giant, huge, monstrous mystery and then break it down into sort of mini mysteries, understand what are the key elements of this investigation, this mystery, and then one by one, if you're successful, you look at each piece and you solve that and move on to the next piece until finally, by 2009, I had essentially put all the pieces together except for one, which was where it came from. That was the big mystery as to why the Chupacabra suddenly appeared out of nowhere in 1995. And nobody had discovered that. And that was sort of the final missing piece of the puzzle that I finally solved, and with that, to my mind, I pieced it all together.
So where else did you go in search of Chupacabra?
And Chupacabras. Well, I live in New Mexico, and so I was fortunate in that a couple of the Chupacabras were sighted not too far from me. In fact, there was one found a couple miles from where I live. So I sort of had a local connection. So I was able to investigate some of those Chupacabra mysteries that were local here in New Mexico. And then, of course, again, I went to Cuero, Texas for the Canyon Chupacabra. I also went to Puerto Rico and interviewed the original eyewitness, Madeline Tolentino, whose sighting and from whose sighting the most famous image of Chupacabra worldwide came from. So I interviewed her, and I also did background research in Puerto Rico. I went to El Yunque Rainforest, which is allegedly the home of Chupacabra, where it first came from. Cool. I interviewed eyewitnesses there. And then to round it off, I also went to the jungles of Nicaragua in Central America, and I spent just under a week searching the pretty remote area near the border between Costa Rica and Nicaragua, near the San Juan River, where I, in my judgment, it was probably the most likely place to find an extant population of existing chupacabras. And so I did some field research and investigations out there, and I hired a tracker and everything.
So you took this work pretty seriously then? You were in search of answers, not just to disprove the legend.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one thing that I try to do in all my work is it always puzzles me when I hear people who are interested in the paranormal, particularly believers. I don't really like the word believers because I don't think it's particularly useful, although it is good shorthand, so I'll just use it for now. But who think that because I approach these subjects from a skeptical point of view, that I don't take them seriously. I would actually argue it's exactly the opposite. I do take it seriously. And, you know, I wouldn't have spent 5 years researching Chupacabra if I didn't take it seriously. And whether the subject is ghosts or crop circles or what have you, absolutely. I believe these subjects deserve to be taken seriously. They deserve to have good scientific methodologies brought to them. Absolutely. And so, in fact, I remember a couple of years back, I was giving a talk at a Bigfoot conference in Idaho. And I was the token skeptic, of course. I mean, it was like, you know, like we have all the believers, and then Radford comes on, and I'm ducking tomatoes and stuff. And I'm talking to the crowd, and, you know, I mean, we got along pretty well and everything. And, you know, they enjoyed having a sort of refreshing, you know, escape from the echo chamber, as it were. But one thing that I told the audience there, who, again, were, you know, probably 95% believers in Bigfoot, was I said, look, you know, I'm not the enemy here. I'm taking this seriously. I'm here, you know, I'm not making fun of you. I'm not laughing at you. You know, unlike the rest of America, I mean, I tell you what, if you walk outside these doors and walk down the street and tell people you believe in Bigfoot, a lot of the general public will make fun of you, and they will not take it seriously. I'm here. I'm doing legitimate research. I'm doing the best I can. I do field research. I do archival research. I do all sorts of investigations. And so as far as I'm concerned, we're on the same page. We may approach it from different points of view, and, you know, some more skeptically and some less skeptically. But in the end, you know, if the chupacabra's out there or Bigfoot's out there or ghosts are out there, that's great. I get paid the same either way. I don't have a vested interest. I don't have a dog in this fight. So there, that's where I come from on it.
Hey, Ben, this is Doug. Let me ask you a question.
Hey, Doug.
On that. This is my own question.
Mm-hmm.
So given what you just stated,
mm-hmm.
why do so many people place you in that category of hardcore skeptic?
Well, it's interesting. I think there's a couple reasons. One is that on more than one occasion, I've had people who only hear about me by reputation, and they I don't know, they saw some interview I did or they read something I did, and for whatever reason, they got some impression of me and my methodologies that I was some dismissive debunker that was denying everything. And you know, when they actually meet me, I've had several people come up to me and say, you know what, you're not an a-hole. I mean, it's like, you know, I kind of expected an a-hole, but you're actually, and I'm like, well, thanks, I guess. I mean, I don't know why that is. To be honest with you, I think that most people who have that opinion haven't really taken the time to read what I've written. And I get people all the time who are saying, why do you say that Bigfoot can't exist? And my answer is, what are you talking about? I have never have I said that Bigfoot can't exist. I've never said that ghosts don't exist. I've never made that statement. You can look through everything I've written, everything I've said, all my interviews. I've never said that. So, you know, you obviously are coming, you know, you're a lot of these people are imposing their own interpretations on what I'm saying. So, you know, I think that a lot of it is misunderstanding or maybe just not taking the time to hear the skeptical point of view and to, because I think there's a lot of talking to the choir on both sides of this. And I think that that's one of the reasons I was excited to be on the show is to, you know, get some crosstalk here. I mean, have some discussions and debates, not just sort of the skeptics whining about and bitching about the believers and the believers bitching and whining about the skeptics.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing that's funny about it is it almost parallels what's going on in the regular political picture. I mean, nobody wants to have a polite debate anymore. People just are so polarized. And the thing of it is that, you know, that's not any way to get anything accomplished. You know?
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I've seen you on several documentaries, and you know, it's always been the believers versus either you or Joe or Randy or Shermer. Anyway, you know, and so I wanted, you know, it's like, and I know how documentaries work. I mean, I know that they can edit and they can position, and they do. And so you kind of got automatically positioned in that group.
Right.
And unfortunately, with documentaries, we don't have the benefit of hearing what you've got to say within context. So,
exactly.
So you know, so my impression was, and I was, as I told Brian, I was eager to have you on to hear your side of it so that I could be positively impressed, you know, so I could adjust my impression. And so far, it sounds good. And that's exactly the way we approach it, really. You know, Paranexus is different that way. We're neither believers nor skeptics. We're, let's just see what we've got. What is it? What does the evidence tell us? What do the facts tell us? Let's find out.
Absolutely. And that's, I think that's important. And, you know, is it, you know, sometimes people say, well, you know, but the skeptics can be nasty. Well, the skeptics can be nasty. Believers can't. Everybody can be nasty.
Yeah.
I mean, in any organization, any group of people with a similar mindset, you can find, you know, some example of somebody who did something that was, you know, unethical, nasty, condescending, whatever. I mean, one thing I always say is, you know, whenever I hear someone say, well, the skeptics say, I'm like, hold on, Joe, which skeptic? Who exactly are you talking about? Because don't lump me in with everybody else. I mean, if a specific skeptic says something that you think is, you know, libelous or cruel or nasty, then say that. Call that person out. But don't just say this broad, homogenized, well, the skeptics say. What the hell does that mean?
Hey, Brian's got a question, and we've just got another question, pretty much the same question. He's got a question from the Inception Radio Network chat room, which we welcome everybody from that network as well. But we just got another one similar in the Blog Talk Radio chat. Brian, you want to?
Yeah, from the Inception Radio Network chat, the question is, does Ben believe that any claims of the paranormal are true? If so, which ones?
Well, that's pretty broad.
it's kind of a hard question.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
It'd be hard for me to answer that, to be honest. It'd be hard for me to answer that, too.
Yeah, I mean, do I think some are true? I think it's possible that some are true. Again, anything is possible. I get this where people will say, well, isn't it possible that this... Sure, anything's possible. I mean, that's how science works, is, you know, science is never definitive. And just because we don't have good evidence today or tomorrow doesn't mean we might not have good evidence next month or next year. So, you know, I'll answer the question that I think he's asking, which is, he or she's asking, which is... of all the areas, which one do I think might have the most credibility? And I would say, in my opinion, one of two things. One would either be sea monsters, you know, some sort of unknown, large, probably not gigantic, but some unknown creature, maybe like the coelacanth that, you know, lives in ocean trenches that we haven't just come across yet, for whatever reason. I think that's far more likely than thinking that, you know, Bigfoot exists in North America. And in another realm, I would say probably something along the lines of intuition. I'm not talking of intuition in some sort of paranormal supernatural way, but in terms of a more psychological.
Parapsychological.
Well, yeah. I have my degree's in psychology, and I'm well aware of the ways in which we can sort of know information without knowing how we know it, if you understand. And so I think that there may be something to intuition, Again, I don't think it's necessarily a supernatural thing, but it may sort of be a mechanism that we don't fully understand.
Good. All right. So that answers that question. Brian?
So just kind of turn a little bit away from the Chupacabra for a second.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Since we're talking about Paranexus, you know, we consider ourselves to be a science-based organization. And last week on this particular show, Paranexus Universe, we had a panel discussion, and we were talking about parapsychology, and the subject of belief came up. How big of a part do you feel belief is when dealing with a client-based paranormal investigation?
Well, belief is a big part, especially, a lot of these paranormal subjects and claims come down to eyewitness testimony, for better or worse, usually for worse, whether it's you know, Bigfoot, you know, UFOs, psychic powers, ghosts, what have you. There is obviously some evidence that's put out there, you know, images, videotapes, this and that. But the majority of it, as you guys know, is personal experience. And because of that, you have to look at the person's experience, and you have to try and figure out why are they experiencing it in that particular way. And the most common case when I come in across this is in ghost investigations. It's not as important, for example, if someone is talking about a Bigfoot sighting or a lake monster sighting or Chupacabra sighting, even though their worldview definitely is important in informing that. But it's especially important in my experience with ghosts because, you know, what people's beliefs in ghosts are very personal. Oftentimes, you know, their beliefs, you know, it's not just ghosts. It's also wrapped up in there's like a web of beliefs, including reincarnation, life after death, NDEs, you know, near-death experience, and a variety of things. And so. So I think that particularly in ghost investigations, it's crucial to understand what the person's belief is. There's one case that I investigated. It's one of my chapters in my scientific paranormal investigations book, where there was a haunted house in Buffalo that had a laundry list of you know, really kind of weird haunting evidence type stuff, and I ended up solving the case and all that, but. But in my explanation for that, it was important for me to interview the people that were experiencing it in the house and understand what their worldview was. And, you know, for example, it was important for me to know that they had called in a priest to exorcise the house and things like that. So when I explained my investigation to them, I couched it within the terms that they would accept within that worldview.
Mm-hmm. Which is absolutely critical.
I think it is, and again, that sort of goes back to my psychological approach to it.
Yeah, well, I think, that, like I said, it's absolutely imperative that you do that on any investigation because if you skip over that, then you miss so much information, so much subtle information that can lead you to different kind of. Avenues to explore as to what's really going on in the home. I would say that in our experience, and I'm sure Doug would agree with me, Brian too, probably 98% of the times we've gone out, you know, there's been many psychological or psychodynamics involved that, you know, have influenced these people and their belief system.
Mm-hmm,
and like absolutely. You said, what's important about the belief system, I think what you were so eloquent about it was the fact that that it was all interlinked with other parts of their belief system. So that's really, I've seen that, and I know Doug has too, on more than one occasion when we're interviewing clients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because if you don't understand the mindset and the worldview of the person that's telling you something, then you're missing out on half of their meaning. Because, you know, a person can have an experience that is, you know, has a unique meaning to them. And, you know, for example, I was in the case where someone had said, well, I saw a ghost, and I'm thinking that she's referring to sort of a white shimmering, you know, creature that was, you know, floating through her kitchen. And this was early in my career. And I later, actually, after I talking to her more and more, I realized that what she meant by ghost was a comforting feeling at night when she went to sleep. So I was like, oh, okay. And it was like, okay, I mean, that's, it's important to understand when someone says, I saw a ghost or I saw something, you know, one initial question is, what do you mean by that? What does that mean to you?
Yeah.
So we have another question in the chat room. Have you done any investigating or have any thought or theory on the Bell Witch haunting?
I have not done anything on the Bell Witch case. I know a little bit about it from my limited research. It sounds like it's very, very heavily influenced by folklore. You know, it may be one of those cases where it was so long ago that, you know, good luck finding any original resources to really references to go to it. But I haven't personally investigated, but I know some about it.
Yeah, I agree. There's probably a lot more folklore than truth.
And here's the problem. Let me just interject this regarding the Bell Witch case or any other.
That was like over 150 years ago,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah,
yeah.
Early 1800s. The problem with this entire field, any part of it, is that it's unfalsifiable. You can't prove it right or wrong. And so, you know, if you really want to get technical about it, you can't, there is no position. I mean, it all comes back to belief. What does the evidence show? Is there strong significance in something? Is there a compelling argument for something? So that's what it kind of comes down to, because we can't prove it right or wrong. We can't prove it true or false.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And that often occurs in many of the historical cases that I look into. There's also the Jeff the Talking Mongoose, if you know that story.
Oh, yeah.
Where, you know, I mean, who the hell knows what these people are doing? It's, you know, to my mind, the most solvable ones are the ones that are occurring, you know, either concurrent with us or, you know, for example, the Chupacabra, or ones that were within the last, you know, a few decades at least, where you have eyewitnesses that you can still interview. And so, you know, for example, you look at the Beast of Gévaudan, you know, the maybe werewolf vampire thing that attacked, you know, people in France in, I think, 17-something. You know, I mean, who the hell knows at this point? I mean, there's so much out there, you know, in terms of who can tease out what's conjecture, what's rumor, what's fact. I mean, it's not that it's not worth doing, but at some point, you know, it's you sort of say, well,
it's almost futile looking back to try to analyze what happened. And it is futile to try to analyze what happened in the past. You can't even be halfway accurate. But I think, you know, what you say about what separates the wheat from the chaff on that one is, you know, like everything's got to be, you know, cumulative, and it's all based on hearsay or somebody told somebody anecdotal. So, I mean, you know, it can't possibly be. It just makes it so difficult.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, just expand on that very briefly. I mean, there was I hear that a lot from some of the critics, not necessarily of me, but of skeptics, where they'll occasionally accuse skeptics of intentionally choosing weak cases to investigate. So they say, well, okay, maybe Radford solved these cases, but you know, those were the easy ones. Well, what do you mean easy? You know, I spent weeks and months on that, and what the hell did you do? But to my mind, that speaks to the issue of, you know, as an investigator, I want the best cases. I do not shy away from the best evidence in the best cases. Those are the ones I want. I mean, why the hell would I waste my time on some half-baked, you know, some, you know, third-person story from 1938
or
1820
right? When if there's a case that's, you know, that's eminently investigatable, that has good hard evidence, I'm not going to shy away from that. I'm going to go right to that.
Preach it, brother.
Yep. Yeah, well, we're still waiting for the case that's going to knock our socks off, too. You know, and you're always hoping that that's going to happen, and, you know, and you're not, you never rule it out. You can't, but you certainly have to. I think if you're really serious about doing an investigation and really want to try to find out what's going on here, you have to really be very careful, and we've talked about this many times, about examining your own belief system and how that may influence how you approach any kind of investigation, whether it's cryptozoology or hunt, or, you know, looking to try to investigate paranormal activity or whatever. You have to really examine it, and I see a lot of problems with folks, and I know you guys probably mutually agree with me on this, that just go out there with a bunch of flashlights and flashing meters and other stuff that think that they're investigators.
Right.
You know?
Oh, yeah. I wrote a whole chapter on that. Yeah, I wrote all of Chapter 4 was basically deconstructing the ghost hunters' techniques and explaining in detail why virtually all of them are completely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd really like to dig into that, actually. I've been waiting for this opportunity to uncork the Chapter 4. Because
the infamous chapter
four. No, I think it's great. I mean, well, I picked up your book. I had to force myself to read through the beginning because I just wanted to jump ahead. And I agreed with everything in there. And you know, when I read your article in the Skeptical Inquirer, you know, I wasn't afraid of anybody seeing me buy it or anything at the bookstore. I was excited to read the whole article.
It's like buying the National Inquirer.
Unlike Playboy, right?
Well, yeah, that, you know,
but you pick up
a round paper bag, I'm fine with
exactly.
that.
Exactly. You got to wear it over your head.
Right.
Well, it's all good. That's how I feel when I pick up Taps Para magazine. You know, I got to hide it. I got to hide that underneath the penthouse. You know.
But I mean, I'm standing there reading this article, and you know, people are reading books and magazines and drinking their coffee, and I'm sitting here laughing. I'm laughing at this because it's so damn true, and it's great to hear it. You know, put into good perspective, you know, the reality of what we're doing and how we're screwing it up and how we look like a bunch of idiots and how, you know, we've learned from TV. And it is, you know, it's a big debate in our field about is TAPS good or bad? Is Ghost Hunters good or bad for our culture of ghost investigation? And I think you hit the nail on the head writing that article. One show basically did ruin it all.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's one thing that I found striking when I was researching the TAP stuff. I was reading in one of their books where, in fact, I think I quoted in the book where one of the guys, I guess it was Jason, was talking about how the reason they started TAPS was because they were unsatisfied with the low quality of ghost investigations, and they were going to set the bar higher. I'm like, really, dude? Wow. How's that working out for you?
Well, they got it on TV.
Well,
so.
You know, I'll tell you what, though. In all fairness to them, I never watched their show anymore. I watched at the beginning. I think at the beginning, when they were somewhat new, I think that they tried to approach it the right way. I just think, unfortunately for them, that as the show gained popularity, they really had to prostitute themselves to the network and do what the network wanted. And the network wanted dramatic, you know, sensationalizing mm-hmm. things. And so I think if you know, I think TAPS, you know, when you're driving around in $50,000 Tahoes or, you know, whatever they are, Lincoln Navigators or whatever they may be, Cadillac Escalades, it's hard to, you know, like turn that down.
Yeah, you may be right. I mean, I haven't watched all their episodes because, frankly, I get tired of laughing. But, but it you know, I've seen some of them and, you know, I think that, you know, I don't think that they're necessarily hoaxing. I know there's been some accusations about their hoaxing. I don't really know whether the other people can make up their own minds. But, you know, I just can't believe that you know, after, you know, what, 6-7 seasons now, they haven't recognized that they're not getting any good evidence. That, you know, that,
oh, yeah,
that if their purpose is... You know, if their purpose really is to find good hard evidence of ghosts, and if they're really sincere in this, you would think at some point they'd say, you know what, this ain't working. Whatever we're doing is not working. But
then,
it doesn't.
Poof, go the Escalades.
Yeah.
Well, you know what?
When they're not dramatic and selling product anymore, poof.
Well, I agree. I tell you what, I mean, on occasion, I've been asked to do really sort of outlandish type stunts for TV shows. And my answer is no thanks.
Yeah, but you know, what I meant about those guys was I think to some degree they tried to they had a little skepticism in some of their stuff, and I think as I said, as the show rolled on, I didn't watch it all that much after maybe the first season, and then it just got a little flakier and flakier, you know, to the point where it's like this is really hard to take. But hey, you know, they were pioneers in a sense, and now look at how many off spins that show created.
Well, look, here's my issue on that is that the problem is that people who know something about this, we who know about these things.
Amen.
come on. It's like, you know, at least we come at it from a certain understanding and knowledge behind this and whatever. I mean, if they want to pull the wool over other people's eyes. But, you know, I'm worried about the average people who don't know anything about this. In fact, there's been some cases, and I'll just finish this thought, is in the case that I mentioned, the buffalo hunting that I discussed in one of my chapters in the book, the ghost hunters and the Taps guys have directly caused problems. They've directly been responsible for people being scared out of their wits. And I've seen this. And so it's not just a matter of these guys doing their cute little show and maybe it's real, maybe it's not. No, these guys have done actual damage. And I've seen that in person. I have to clean up their mess, and it pisses me off.
Well, we agree with you 100% because we've seen the same thing. And, you know, early on, you know, coming from the healthcare profession, you know, I suggested that we adopt, you know, the approach of do no harm. And I think that that's been left out. And, you know, we've seen that. We had we did an investigation in Ocala, Florida one time with a young couple who had a baby. And the baby was 18 months old and that they were afraid of, you know, some stuff that was going on there. And I'm not sure if it was them, but another group in that area somewhere had called in another group previously. And they came in and told them that, you know, that they were in some deep trouble. And, you know, I think, Doug, you remember it better. They really scared the heck out of them, you know, you know, unnecessarily, and told them that they couldn't cleanse it or do something like that. A lot of mumbo jumbo and scared them and did more harm than good.
Yeah.
And so we've really hammered our audience when we've done our teaching shows about not doing any harm to the person.
Not promoting fear.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, and I'm glad that you guys, you know, hit on that, because that's, to my mind, that's really an element of this whole ghost hunter stuff that's been overlooked. You know, people, again, you can either accept the ghost, you know, the Taps guys as you know, doing what they're doing. It's either real or not real, or you either like their show or you don't. But there needs to be more people who are standing up and saying that you know, they're actually doing harm. It's not just entertainment. They actually are harming people. And I think we've all seen that. And I have yet to hear either any of the ghost hunters crew sort of, you know, acknowledge that. They're just like, oh, well, you know, they're on the fence. Sometimes it's just a TV show. It's just entertainment. We're actually looking for ghosts. Okay, fine, well, good. But what else?
That is true.
We think you have a malevolent spirit, and we'll see you in a couple of months or, you know, the show's over with. Good luck.
Take back your power. What you said was true. But yet, that's not what the public sees. TV, stuff like that, absolutely different than what we do. Completely different. But the public doesn't see that. And you're right. With these cases, harm has been done. And this is a crucial point for anybody who would be an anomalous researcher or investigator. Make sure, number one, you do no harm. And number two, you don't promote fear. And you can do harm by not educating the client properly.
Exactly. Hear, hear.
And by all means, respect their belief system in that process. That's just as important.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole running around in the dark with flashlights, that's not scientific?
You speak blasphemy, Brian.
Oh, come on.
I want to break out my flashing meter here. It means something to me.
It just seems like the show has spawned people to, you know, when I first started out, I'll admit, I did the investigations of cemeteries and things like that. That was just the culture. That's how you started out. But then you reach the point where you take the fork in the road. Are you going to continue to screw around and get into trouble and eventually fade away? Or are you going to take this stuff seriously? I mean, I decided to take it seriously. And it just seems like now the role models that we have on TV, people take that as training, as reality. So they're, you know, they're mocking what they see, and they're going out, and it's all about the subjective experience. These guys aren't out to help anybody. They're only there for their own entertainment and their own thrill. And I think people don't really realize that. they think that they're helping clients, but really they're just reenacting television. They're running around with a flashlight in the dark. They're running around, you know, with their digital recorders, picking up the dog barking across the street and thinking it's a voice. You know,
yeah,
they jump to conclusions.
It's bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre. And you know, I traced back, I would say, and you guys probably know this better than I do, but I would guess that well over 90% of the ghost investigation groups in North America and around the world are patterned directly after TAPS and ghost centers. And just, I mean, where else are they going to get it? I mean, they're not. Hopefully, a few of them are reading my book, but most of them aren't. They're like, oh, it's TV. The TV guys must know what they're doing.
I think it's without being sounding too mean, it's almost like they're always at a perpetual Star Trek convention.
Right. That's true.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like that. It's more of a club, you know, a social thing than it is. Seriously,
it's a status. It's a
we
status
all get a cool-looking T-shirt, a right. cap, and we get a flashlight. That'll burn your eyes out if you get too close to it.
Exactly.
And we like to investigate in the dark. I mean, we kick that around. Why do you need to investigate in the dark?
Exactly.
Why do you need right. 15 people in an investigation? I mean, yeah, we all started off that way. To some degree, but I mean, you know, if Paranexus does an investigation, we may have three people do an investigation. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen cases where I've been there where other so-called investigation groups and ghost hunter groups are doing their so-called investigation, and I'm just sitting back watching these people trip over each other. You know, one guy is talking and having a beer in the next room while, you know, where one of his buddies is in the next room over, you know, trying to get EVPs. Uh-huh. And, you know, the guy burps and he's like, oh, my God, I just talked to Beelzebub. No, dude, you didn't.
Sorry to bring you down.
It's just amazing to me, and I just sit there and you know, I mean, I try to do with a lot of my stuff is I try to help people, you know, bring some science to it, and this is ultimately what I find most offensive about the ghost hunter guys is they're not taking it seriously. If you're going to take it seriously, then take it seriously.
Evolve.
Use some science. Use some critical thinking. Learn from your mistakes. But they're not taking it seriously. And if they did, then it would be a very different show. But
well, I think it's you know, you, first of all, that's kind of hard for some of those folks, you know. And they don't even crack a book to begin with. And I don't mean that in a really bad way. I mean, it's just some folks, that's not their cup of tea. And, you know, they'd rather get it all on TV, and that's okay. But, I mean, the bottom line is if you're serious about this, you know, you really have to make yourself have some understanding of what factors may be involved. If you don't, and that usually requires that you crack more than one book, a couple of them, then, you know, that's not a lot of fun for folks.
Right. You're right. I mean, I talk about that in sort of towards the end of chapter four where I say, you know, why don't people take this seriously, you know, particularly in ghost hunting? And the answer is because it's not sexy. It's not, you know, it's not the dramatic stuff that you see on TV. I mean, as an investigator of these topics, half my time is spent, you know, in library archives researching it. I don't spend my time, you know, I mean, yeah, on occasion I do field work and I do actually do a fair amount of it. But, you know, it's not the sexy, glamorous TV crap. It's, you know, it's real research, and real research takes time and effort and you know, and some scholarship. And I see none of that.
And it doesn't happen overnight. It's something that you got to work at.
Exactly. You
know? It's just really, it's interesting, you know, it really is. And, you know, the other thing that really kind of blew our minds was we, and Doug, primarily Doug, created this course. And the purpose of the course was just to go over some general knowledge and some general approaches, ways to approach, you know, doing investigations in a reasonable manner, using reasonable methodologies that somebody with probably like an eighth grade education could understand. And you know what? We got more criticism about that we were
really?
That we were selling out, and that, you know, how could you certify anybody, you know, you scumbags. And you know, and it was just like, I was wondering when the people were going to come around, you know, with pitchforks. You know, standing outside of Doug's house down there in Punta Gorda, Florida, you know.
Burning a cross.
Burning him in effigy with pitchforks and all stuff. You know, all because we're trying to certify him. And it was just like, you know, it's just like burn the books. So it's just like, wow. It was, and that was really, you know.
Interesting.
It happened, you know. It was just, wow.
Well, because I've occasionally thought about trying to like put together like a little lecture. I mean, I actually do an investigation seminar and workshop and stuff. And I've been thinking about doing a little video thing, but it's interesting that you got so much criticism from people.
Oh, we did. We got a ton of it, you know.
Wow.
And there are people that were just really nasty. You know, like how can you? You know, like we had turned our backs on the community, and all if we just said, you know, I think Doug. We sent him a couple free copies of the book, you know, just to say, take a look at it, you know, and what do you find offensive, and let us know, because that's the true spirit of Paranexus, you know. It's like, you know, we want to have a forum, and we were just surprised.
Wow.
I think that kind of goes back to the whole education by television. I've read something on, somebody wrote a status on their Facebook about, you know, thank goodness for these TV shows, because I don't know how I would have learned about this field. And I just, you know, to think I spent all this time and all this money on, you know, starting out with parapsychology and psychology. And I mean, I have probably about 100 books on different subjects that have brought me to where I'm at today. And, you know, it's one of the points you brought up in your article, and I'm pretty sure it's in the book too, about people think that there are no experts in our field. You know, that you don't need any specialized training or education in any kind of aspect. Oh, I guess all you need is TV. But, you know, I think people are really missing out if they're not rounding out their education, especially not just science, but, you know, interpersonal communication and interviewing skills. You know, anything that can help you.
Absolutely. I mean, and that was one of the early things that I, when I was really putting together my thoughts and my experience on this, was realizing that in many ways, as you guys know, in ghost investigations, as in paranormal investigation generally, it's a Wild West show. I mean, there are so many self-proclaimed experts. You go to a typical, you know, either a paranormal convention or ghost convention or even, you know, Dragon Con or wherever else, you can't throw a rock without hitting somebody who claims to be some, you know, top-notch expert, because he was on, you know, because he did some, you know, self-published book and he was on the local news for you know, doing a ghost case. And whatever, I mean, I understand that, but, you know, it's also true that's they miss the larger point, which is that if you're doing investigations, investigation is an expertise. There are people whose job is investigation. This is not something that just anybody who's a pizza delivery driver, accountant, or fireman can do. Or plumber, better yet. I mean, again, that's not knocking, and that's not an insult. It's just a matter of fact where, you know, it's simply not true that anybody can do investigations. Doing successful investigations, I mean, look, anybody can walk around, you know, a house at night in the dark, you know, with an EVP, with a, you know, looking for EVPs and with a flashlight. That's not investigating. But to do actual investigations, some of the stuff that I do and some of the stuff that you guys do, it does require some knowledge and experience and work. And I think that, you know, to my mind, that's what distinguishes my work from many other people's, is that I have a track record of successes. I mean, I can point to, you know, a dozen or more reasonably high profile cases, the Chupacabra being the most recent, where I'm like, you know, you can think that I'm full of it, or you can either agree or disagree with my book. But the fact of the matter is, I've solved these cases. And, you know, what have the TAPS guys done?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of investigations at a lot of really cool places. Sure would like to have gone to some of those places they've gone. I have it all paid for.
That would be cool.
Yeah, you know, just for the sake of going there, you know. Lap Castle comes to mind. That'd be a pretty cool place.
Hey, Ben, here's a question from the Inception Radio Network chat. Kind of a follow-up to an earlier question. You haven't found proof that ghosts exist, correct?
I've looked. I've done my best to look. I have yet to find good proof that ghosts exist.
Okay, The question is, have you found any evidence that suggests to you that they exist?
I haven't found any good evidence. I keep looking. Unfortunately, the majority of the evidence that's offered to me it falls apart. It's either clearly, you know, people will give me photographs of orbs, you know, that are self-evidently, you know, flash reflections of dust and objects in the room. So
I'll get us started.
Yeah. So you know, I that being said, I mean, if somebody tomorrow or next year, next month gives me good information, gives me better evidence, I'm not going to ignore it. I'll be happy to look at it. I don't dismiss it out of hand. I will respectfully, you know, I'll do my best to understand it. But unfortunately, the quality of the evidence that I've seen, and I have looked, I mean, I've been looking for over a decade now, fails to meet even basic scientific standards. So you know, you can either suggest that my standards are too high. I would suggest that the quality of evidence is too low.
With that being said, have mm-hmm. there been any cases where you've scratched your head? Where I don't think we're ever going to get to a point where we can say that's, you know, it's significant. You know, the evidence is significant. You know, but it almost is like it teeters close at times on certain things, and it just makes
sure.
me. You know, I mean, I'm of the same ilk, but there's been some things that have left me scratching my head because. Mm-hmm. They seemed a little bit out of place.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I can give you some examples of things that I didn't understand. Where, I mean, for example, in one of the cases in my investigations book, there was a very strange case. It was the Buffalo haunting, where a guy said he was actually attacked at night by a ghost. He was kicked at night. He was being attacked, and you know, that's kind of unusual. People, someone mm-hmm. claiming they're being attacked by a ghost, and I was interested to follow up on the claim. And that was sort of one of the key mysteries. And for the longest time, I couldn't explain it. I was like, I have no idea what this could be. I mean, is there really a ghost here? Is someone playing a prank? Is it, you know, some psychological thing? So, you know, I eventually solved that case and I figured out what it was. But before I did, you know, find that final piece of the puzzle, it was mysterious. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I had no idea what the hell it was. But to my mind, you know, I guess one difference is that I don't just stop at that point. I don't just do an investigation and then I find something that I can't explain or I can't solve, and I say, well, hey, I guess it's a mystery. What's next? No, I keep going. I keep trying. I keep trying different things. I keep working at it. And so far, in most of the cases, you know, if you keep working at it and you try harder and you keep trying, then you can solve the mystery. And that's what I did in that case.
Do you think that sometimes, I've often wondered this, that if these are psychic projections from the person that you're investigating, that's experiencing, maybe they're externalizations of mm-hmm. what they're feeling internally, and they project it into their world or their reality?
Yeah, I've heard that. I think it's sort of like the tulpas idea. I was talking to a guy named Christopher O'Brien a couple weeks back, and he suggested that the chupacabra might be a sort of a collective manifestation of beliefs about the chupacabra.
A cultural, yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
I didn't read your book, but I'm sure that had to play a big part with that.
Well, no, but what? I mean, I agree with that part, but if I understood him correctly, what he was saying was that it literally created something, that mm-hmm. the collective belief wasn't just a delusion, it wasn't just mass hysteria in some cases.
Oh, okay,
but,
yeah,
but
yep.
It literally somehow, you know, if 51% of the world believes it, it's like,
yikes, you know, that sounds like Forbidden Planet, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Monsters from the Id.
Yeah. And I mean, it's an interesting idea. I mean, I know of zero credible evidence that if enough people believe something, suddenly it's true. I'd be curious to know what the evidence is for that. But it's an interesting idea.
Yeah, it certainly is, especially when you think of it if it happens in a group situation. mm-hmm. you know, and you know, the things that kind of make me wonder about that too would be like, you know, where people have like at Fatima, or you know, where they've seen the sun spin around. You know, how much of that is like, you know, a groupthink sort of thing where, you know, everybody gets off on the same thing.
Well, I mean, no, that's a good example, and I'll just talk briefly about that, because, you know, when you look at some of those mass hysteria cases or some of those sort of group cases of miracles, you know, as you pointed out, in some places, like, for example, in Fatima, many pilgrims claim that the sun danced around the sky. I mean, it's not just one person says, I mean, literally dozens and hundreds of people said they saw this. But, I mean, here, again, what is more likely? Is it more likely that this is sort of a collective delusion, or is it more likely that the sun actually did dance around the sky? I mean, in this particular case, you know, we're all under the same sun. The sun, you can ask astronomers, the sun did not dance around the sky.
Right.
So we do have objective verification that what people are claiming happened did not, in fact, happen. So in that particular case, you know, it's pretty clear that the people are experiencing basically a collective delusion.
Hey, Ben, I've got a couple of questions from the chat room. We're running out of time here, so we have to keep the answers really brief.
Sure.
The first one is back on evidence of ghosts' existence. You stated the majority of evidence given to me falls apart. The question is, so some evidence he's been given does not fall apart. What is that evidence? Or was that just an expression?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I think the answer is it falls apart in different ways. So, for example, in some cases, particularly in ghost cases, it falls apart because another person that was in the same area recollects it differently, and they remember something completely different.
So what evidence – do you have any evidence that has not fallen apart? That's the question.
I haven't seen any. There's some evidence that's harder to solve than others. You know, but I have yet to see anything that's really a good hard nugget of evidence.
Okay, and the second question, which will be probably the last one we have time for, have you investigated any cases of demonic possession?
I'm trying to think. I've investigated a couple of cases where people believe there was a demon in the house, but in terms of I haven't actually been there at an exorcism, for example. I've researched and written about exorcisms, but actually haven't been there at one of them, no.
Cool. Brian?
So where can the listeners get your books?
Well, they can find most of my books at radfordbooks.com. That's RADFORDbooks.com. And also chupacabramystery.com, which is easy to remember.
Cool. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show. I was really excited for this pretty much since December. So it was a big treat for me to have you on the show.
Well, I appreciate your advice. Good talking to you.
I loved your book, and I'm telling you, everybody listening in the chat room, listening in the archives, you've got to get this book, Scientific Paranormal Investigation, How to Solve Unexplained Mysteries. It's an excellent, excellent book. If you're serious about uncovering the mysteries of ghosts, UFOs, cryptids.
There should be a link on the show page, too, right now.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, thank you so very much, Ben. You know, come back and visit with us again, because I think I can safely speak for the other guys. We really enjoyed having you, and, you know, we could probably sit here and talk for a long time.
Absolutely. So, I'd love to talk to you guys again. This has been fun.
Yeah, yep. Hang on with us, too.
Pleasure meeting you, sir.
Awesome, you too.
Hang on with us for just a minute. Brian, you can wrap it if you want.
Exit the show. Okay, well, I want to thank Jamie Havikin, the executive producer of Paranexus Universe, especially those in the chat room and those listening in on the archives. And I want to thank Doug and Grant for letting me steer the ship tonight. It was a lot of fun. And listeners of the archives, please visit us at paranexus.org if you want to learn more about Paranexus and what we're all about. Next week we have on Paranexus Universe the Mayan Book of the People and the Native American Paranormal Connection with Ron Slusher.
Ooh, that sounds good.
Yeah.
That's all I got.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, thanks, everybody, and thanks to Kevin MacLeod for providing the cool music at the ending. And great job, Brian. We'll get your butt back on here more often.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, by sure. All means, thank you, Jamie, for a great job behind the scenes. Everybody have a great weekend coming up. We'll talk to you soon.
Take care.